Hello, I'm Paul McInnes, and you're listening to a special Music Weekly Extra from Guardian.co.uk. This is the full, unexpurgated interview between myself and Tiga. Tiga,
yeah.
Congratulations on making an amazing album.
Sound very sincere.
Yeah, well, I know. Do you enjoy getting potentially insincere praise from strangers?
It's insincere, sincere. It's all the same.
Do you get a lot of people coming up to you and going, oh, I really love that set, or I really love the album? How do you deal with that when it happens?
Well, it's easy to deal with. You know, of all the things that happen in when you're making records or promoting records, there's a lot of things that are tricky to deal with, or it's a bit of a mind trip, whatever, but praise for your record's not one of them. I think I enjoy it, and I take it quite seriously. I think it's the only thing I actually do kind of care about.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think. When an individual actually says, you know, they liked your record or they liked a song or whatever, I think that cuts through my otherwise incredibly jaded.
That's really heartwarming. Because I'd imagine that I always have these worries that it would actually form part of a veneer that a kind of an artist would put on themselves to kind of inure themselves from potential disappointment.
I think it's also from being a DJ for so many years. You know, there's an honesty to it. You know, you can see if people aren't dancing, and you can see when they're really going crazy. So you can, you know, there's no point hiding from the truth.
I haven't been following you, I have to confess, but I have been reading your Twitters, your tweets. It said, okay, so I have my album in my hands, looks good, done. Is that sincere? Is that the way you approach your music? Once it's out there, is it gone?
Yes, 100%.
It's like Dickens in his novels, the little children he releases into the world.
Yeah, I think, yeah, 100%. And it's actually one of the things that makes the whole process that comes afterwards, the press and the touring, a little bit difficult because, you know, sometimes as you get deeper and deeper into people wanting to talk about it, you're moving obviously further and further away from the point of completion. I see it as the 99% of everything. I mean, the reason why I do this and what I enjoy is like the creative moment where you solve a problem in studio and you walk home that night and you're like, yeah, I got something, I created something. And that's and everything after that, you're kind of just moving further and further away from it, out of that orbit. And then once you reach a certain point, like right now, for example, you're only really starting to think of the next project, or, you know, which is a nice feeling because you start to get excited again. But I don't know why the things last such a short time. Sometimes I wish they would keep me going a little bit longer, but they don't. There's not much consolation in what you've done.
Is there a cycle at all? Can you continue on a creative level like that, or do you need a period of downtime before you go back into the creative process again?
I think musically, I know, for example, DJing, I find there's a very, what's emerged, I've seen it over the past like 15 years, there's a definite cycle of kind of excitement over a particular style of music. So there'll be moments where, you know, 1 year, everyone, you'll get really, really into a new sound and a new style. And then there's like a few, you know, another year where you're just cruising on that. There's no questions, there's no doubt, there's no anything. And then it'll start to get boring, and then, no, I can't find anything. And then, so.
Do you think that's a limitation in dance music, that those that fashion can take, or musical fashion can take over like that?
No, I mean, I definitely did. I don't see it as a limitation. I mean, I see it more as just, I think it's natural when there's a lot of excitement over something and there's a lot of kind of passion, it's going to hit a certain high that can't be sustained, I don't think, in any style.
Really. And eventually it kills that sound, doesn't it, quite often?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, it kills. I mean, it depends. You can look at it different ways. I mean, it can kill the sound, or you can just kind of get bored of the sound. You know, that's how I look at it. For myself, I don't. When I think back on the styles that I was really in love with and moved on from, I don't know. I remember buying drum and bass records.
Well, this is what I'm thinking at the same time as well.
You know, so I don't. It's not. I don't necessarily feel like. I don't know if it got killed off as much as I just. I don't know, got bored of it.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking of drum and bass. Like how they would rinse one particular drum sound or one particular bass sound for 6 months.
It's true.
And then you would get to the point, I never want to hear that noise again, the noise I loved so much.
That's true, exposure.
How would you describe your lyrical style?
You mean the singing or the writing?
The writing.
The writing. I don't know, it's quite spontaneous, usually. It usually happens quite quickly. Most of the songs I've written, I write it almost like percussion. It's almost like I program drums. It's like I kind of, you know, I don't know, I have a few keywords that I like baby or dance or whatever, you know, and you kind of plug them in almost like you're programming drums. And I don't know. That's how it always started for me. I was really into like Chicago house, and I was really into things like DAF, you know, German, where it was a bit more, yeah, it was quite percussive delivery with breathing and kind of sexual innuendo. And I don't know. And that's just, I guess I started writing like that. Certainly never thinking of it as singing. Yeah, I guess that's my lyrical style. And now it's maybe developed a little bit into rudimentary pop songs.
That's one of the things that really struck me on this album is how well you're talking about the kind of the percussive effect of it, but the way in which it works in the kind of delineation of a song. I think what you need, and that refrain, I've got what you need, baby, and how it kind of can then, yes, exactly, keyword, search on the baby. But that you then go, that then sets off a trigger of huge bass and squalling kind of, I don't know what, but a particular piece of synths. Equipment makes a noise, yeah. And it functions in that way as well as, you know, making a statement in the words. But then you've also got things like, I mean, I'm quite interested in asking you about Luxury, the track, and its lyrical content. Because there's one quite intriguing line in it, I think, luxury giving me peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, peace of mind from what?
I wanted to kind of celebrate a certain superficiality that that I actually feel and felt at the time. And I was kind of, I was spending a lot of time in Paris. And I was just, I don't know, I go to a lot of shops and, you know, I end up filling my days with, I guess, shopping and looking in fancy magazines. I don't know, whatever. And I don't know, and I was writing the song and I just thought, yeah, it does give me peace of mind. I don't know. It's not that I have big demons to. I don't know what I'm from what necessarily, but I guess it's kind of soothing in a weird way. I don't know. I guess it's just escapism. It's like you kind of lose yourself in a kind of fantasy world, Cinderella kind of thing.
Until the visa bill lands, and a lot of people would say that, you know, all this financial cataclysm.
That's why
we have.
That's my song started it.
Exactly. You were dealing in credit default swaps at that very point in time. But a lot of people were kind of like looking forward, particularly in this kind of in the lefty world in which we occasionally inhabit around here. They're looking forward to an end of the age of luxury and certainly an end of excessive consumerism. What would you say to that?
Well, I don't want to. I mean, I'm a Guardian headquarters here. I don't want to come off like some.
No, this is
right wing.
We want controversy.
But I I'm certainly not a defender of the luxury industry. You know, I have nothing at stake. I'm not on the board of LVMH. but what I do think is that I actually, by my own definition, I don't see the age we live in, the mass consumerism and those trends that have kind of got us in this mess. I don't see that at all as the same thing as the kind of pure luxury business. See, and that's actually what my song was a bit about. To me, you know, that luxury, that scene, you know, of boats and cars, it's meant for rich people. You know, it was always meant for rich people. It's not meant for everybody. It's more, I think most of the problems we're in, I don't know if these are popular things to say, but, you know, people maxing out their credit cards or people buying houses they can't afford or everyone thinking somehow they can afford an expensive Louis Vuitton purse. That's where the problem lies, you know? And granted, the luxury companies have obviously marketed themselves in a way to try to trick everyone into thinking they can afford it. But that's the problem, you know? When I grew up, I remember I found a copy of the Robb Report, you know, that ridiculous magazine.
No.
It's like for American tycoons, you know, it's like How to Train Your German Shepherd and you know, it's just everything.
Best shortcuts
schools
in your helicopter.
Switzerland and tax breaks and then a section on boats. And anyway, and I found a copy of it in my father's office or something like that. And I remember looking through it and, you know, there were all these things. And those are things you would just dream about, but there was never any real contact for normal people with that world. And now it's not really like that. I mean, now people have no qualms about spending like a week's salary on a little keychain or something, you know.
So the luxury thing is more about kind of the peace of mind of the rich person rather than the kind of the peace of mind that somebody gets from conducting a transaction.
Yeah. And also, too, I mean, I also think I don't necessarily believe that money doesn't buy happiness, you know?
Ah, that's brilliant. Now we've got the headline. We'll put that in our search terms for the pod. Don't necessarily be, we can maybe market that as a business solution. The Sound of the Shoes.
Yeah.
There's some interlocution between you and a young woman,
yeah,
talking about the combing of the hair and, yeah, and it not happening.
Nothing's happening.
It sounded very glamorous, very very haut.
Yeah, it really wasn't meant to be glamorous. It really wasn't, because in my mind, I was writing it as a member of, you know, that band Maserati. Around Purple Rain era, there was Morris Day and the Time, there was Prince, and there was another band, Maserati, which was actually, you know, the guy, you've seen Purple Rain, yep, obviously, you know, the guy who wears the bandana, he's in Prince, he's in the Revolution, he wears the bandana, yep, always with the Japanese, and he sings that song, Wanna Be a Missionaire, or whatever, Visionaire.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, that was his band. And I was thinking in my mind, like, if I was kind of a, you know, I don't know, maybe a bass player in that band. Like a Minneapolis era kind of sex funk band, like kind of low end, not really that, but in like kind of a regular club hitting on someone, how would I act? So to me, it wasn't really glamorous. It was more, it was quite realistic. It was much more, it was my real song.
Your realness is other people's glamour.
Yeah. And the heels, here's an exclusive. The idea of the heels was actually inspired by my manager. Because he, I doubt if your listeners will find this as amusing as I do. You know when a friend of yours gets like a new item of clothing and all of a sudden they're transformed?
Yes.
Has that ever happened to you? You know, yeah, like, yeah, yeah. And it's kind of annoying. It's like,
I bought a cardigan recently. It did that to me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did your friends pick up on the, were you empowered?
I don't think, I felt empowered.
You
inside.
Felt empowered, exactly. Yeah. Anyway, he bought these boots, okay, these black leather boots. And all of a sudden he was like tough guy, sex man, like just everything was going his way. Everyone else, watch out. And you could hear, I could always hear the boots coming for me. You know, I'd be like, I'd hear click, click, click. And I would know that I was about to be sent on some mission or something was going to happen. So that was the idea. I wanted to immortalize how he was feeling, his newfound strength in that song.
You've basically got like some of the most renowned producers in electronic music on your album. Mm-hmm. Were they just lined up in front of your door begging to be on? I suspect you know them all and you're friends with many of them. Mm. How does it work when you are both in the studio, or say yourself and James Murphy or with Solwax? How does it work when you're in the studio?
It's a little different with everyone. I mean, my strategy sounds bad. Well, I was to befriend them first. And then gradually, hey, why don't we? We're such good friends. Why don't we make something tonight? So I was
put my name on the top of it.
Yeah, no, I was. It depends. I mean, Solwax is a little bit different. We really are very close friends, and we spent a lot of time with each other over the past years. And it is pretty much like working with your friends, you know, like a band in high school or whatever, where we just it's very informal. We know each other really well by this point. You just specifically, usually I come into studio with some general ideas on what I want to make, usually some key kind of lyrical ideas, maybe song title and a few basic melodies. And then we usually just start hammering it out and just adding things here and there. And they obviously do a lot of work and they'll develop something sometimes into a direction I didn't expect it. Sometimes I'll say I hate that or I love that or whatever. And James is a little bit different. Me and James weren't as close. We're good friends, but not quite that close. And James is a little bit more traditional. Like, you know, I went to his studio and with him, I played him demo songs that I had made. I played him like 6 or 7 or 8 songs. He picked the one that he liked the most, which was Sex O'Clock. And then he did a lot of magic work on that. And at the same time, we decided to write something new, and that was Gentle Giant. But it was a great experience working with James. Gonzalez, we wrote together, and that we were like a house on fire. Like it was the first time I ever wrote like that with someone else, and it was just really, really fun.
Do you know him? Do you know him from Montreal? Or
I never knew him in Montreal. I cold called him. I sent him an email about a year and a half ago, just saying basically we should be best friends. Like that was my email. It was just, you know, we have too much in common. I don't necessarily even know or like your music. I just have a feeling. And then we met. I had a stop. I was flying back from Sweden or something. I had a few hours in Charles de Gaulle Airport, so I said, let's meet for. We had a blind date. Basically, we met on a street corner. We met at a children's playground. It was like a pedophiliac. We were like both standing there like, is he the right guy? And we met and we got along really well. And my prediction was right. So,
could you take us back to 6 o'clock? What would you have given to James in the first instance?
In the case of that song, it was actually almost complete. I mean, that one was, the drums we used are the original drums. The bass line, which is essentially the whole song, is the original bass line. And the vocals, actually, we never even redid. James thought they were cool the way they were, and I kind of agreed. So that was a first take. I never even wrote those lyrics down. That was a first take with whatever microphone was lying around. The drum, that track's probably the least changed of anything. But specifically on that one, James did added a lot of little percussive details. It gives a bit of a DFA feel. There's little cowbells at the right moment. And then there's that big synth sound, that boom, 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 this kind of right. we vague conceptual idea to make. I know at home the trains have these weird kind of, in Montreal, the trains have these strange kind of 70s sound effects.
When they arrive in stations?
Yeah, like a ding, ding, ding. So, I don't know, I thought it could be cool to do some kind of time motive synth work that I'm sure no one noticed except for me.
That's interesting. One of my favorite things ever with trains is in Tokyo, Every different tube stop has a different jingle.
Oh, really?
So that people can fall asleep on the trains and then get woken up by their home jingle.
They're incredible, the Japanese.
Aren't they?
Every time I love it there so much. I never noticed that. That's weird because I notice those kinds of things. Every time I'm there, I just go home feeling like a caveman. You feel so... I've been quite a few times, and every time it's one of the only places I never get bored of it. I never get used to it. I always go home feeling so simple. Like I come home, especially to Canada, and I feel like it's a really primitive man, you know, like with simple big houses and simple big food, because they have thought of everything. And it's so fine. And anyway,
I'd just like to kind of go on a slight tangent just to round things up, because I was wondering, and I know the answer to this already because you were talking about Cormac McCarthy on the way in, but you're a bit of a reader. You read quite often, because there's obviously Speak Memory is the name of one of the tracks, the Nabokov biography. And also, I think, got me back to the Twitter thing, you see this circular element to this interview, which I've really planned in advance.
Excellent.
is that you've been having Twitter solidarity with Jake Shears of Sisters Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell, which I loved.
Really?
Yeah.
I couldn't get through it.
Tell me why.
But I've never been a fan of like kind of alternate languages or it just loses me. And I was recommended really highly by a friend of mine, Damien Harris. I don't know if you know, from a Midfield General.
Ah, yes.
No, I don't know. I just didn't like it. I don't even think I made it to 100 pages.
So who is your favorite? Who is your favorite author? Who'd you go back to time and again?
Yeah, Nabokov, I guess. I know it's an easy answer, but I'm humbled every time I read a page. He's incredible. I don't know. Lately, I'm going through a Graham Greene kick right now. I don't know why, but I like him. And
you're feeling guilty about the whole luxury thing. You see, that's what it is. It's gnawing away at you.
Who else? I really like Coetzee. You know, the South African.
Yeah, JM.
He's amazing. I don't know. But I think, you know, I was in university and school and stuff. I was very resistant to reading in general. I mean, I was a good student, and so I'm kind of making up for lost time because I didn't appreciate it as much then as I do now. And I have an enormous amount of time on airplanes and in airports. I have a lot of time inside computers, you know.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tron, thank you very much.
I just realized I'm not in a computer.
Tiga, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.